The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of December 26, 2016. On this week's show, we're bringing back some of our favorite guests for a special year-end edition. First up, Rob Tanner of the Leicester Mercury will join us to talk about his crazy year covering Leicester City's amazing Premier League triumph and what's happened since the club hoisted the trophy. We'll then check in with Mina Kimes of ESPN. We'll talk to her about her story on Martellus and Michael Bennett of the NFL. And finally, we'll have another conversation with Ann Beatty, the widow of Basketball Hall of Famer and Hang Up and Listen icon Zelmo Beatty. Joining me in Washington, D.C. is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan.
Hey, Josh.
Joining us as always from New York is Mike Pesca, the host of Slate's daily podcast, The Gist. Hello, Mike.
Hello. How are you?
Did you guys have a good Christmas?
Well, I can tell you, my family just luxuriated in the Yule. Do you want to reveal? You want to do the big reveal?
Yeah, we're recording this.
Disclose?
We're recording this the week of December 5th. So our edition of Whimsy Watch will be like, hey, what about those? That guy was wearing some crazy socks.
Could you believe what that fan threw on the field?
And the things that they wear on their heads to show that they're not really fans, even though they show up because they're fans.
I can't believe Roger Goodell did that.
So that's always a good thing to say. So, yeah, we're recording this in advance. I don't think there will be any issues except maybe with the Leicester segment. Like something could happen between the time we're recording this and December 26th. So just be advised.
Could they propel themselves to the top of the tables?
I think that's mathematically impossible.
More likely they will propel themselves into the relegation zone while winning the Champions League. They're not going to win the Champions League in the next 2 weeks, but you know.
Anyway, I hope you're enjoying this the week of December 26th. We will enjoy recording it the week of December 5th. In our bonus segment.
Wait, maybe you could listen to it the week of January 15th.
You can listen to whenever the hell you want, I guess.
Yeah.
In our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we're going to talk with everyone's favorite Hang Up guest panelist, Mina Kimes of ESPN. In our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we're going to talk with everyone's favorite Hang Up guest panelist, Mina Kimes of ESPN, about her favorite story of 2016. There's never been a better time to sign up for Slate Plus. For Slate's 20th anniversary, for a limited time, we're offering 30% off an annual membership. $35 for a year of Slate Plus with bonus segments of this and other Slate podcasts every week and a lot more. If you haven't joined, please sign up before this offer goes away. It is slate.com/hangupplus. In our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, our last one of the year, we're going to talk about our favorite Hang Up segments of the year among the three of us. And we'll talk about our favorite sports events of 2016. There has never been a better time to sign up for Slate Plus. For Slate's 20th anniversary, for a limited time, we're offering 30% off an annual membership. That's just $35 for a year of Slate Plus, with bonus segments of this and other Slate podcasts every week, and a lot more. So if you haven't joined Plus yet, sign up before this offer goes away at slate.com/hangupplus. Back in May, 5,001 underdog Leicester City clinched its first championship in England's Premier League. It was the best and most surprising title in a year in which the Chicago Cubs won their first World Series title since 1908. But we all must move on, and there's a new season, and let's look at the standings. And actually, Leicester's not doing that great. They're in 15th place in the 20-team Premier League, a lot closer to relegation than a repeat title. But I'm sure the English papers are going to give them time to find their form. Let's check in. Here's the Mirror. It's official. Leicester City are the worst Premier League champions in history. Well, they are doing quite well in the Champions League. They're at the top of their group. Joining us now to put this all in context, one of our favorite guests from 2016. It's Rob Tanner. He writes about Leicester City for the Leicester Mercury, and he's the author of the book 5001, The Leicester City Story, How We Beat the Odds to Become Premier League Champions. Hey, Rob.
Hi guys, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm wondering what the mood is like. The last check-in with you was right after the title. And since then, so many things have happened. The Premier League performance this year has been a disappointment, but they are doing great in the Champions League. So how are people feeling about the team?
Well, it's a bit mixed at the moment because obviously in the Champions League they're going so well. They set a new record. They didn't concede a goal in the first four games, and which is a record for a club and debut in the competition. And they won the group with ease, with a game to spare. So in the Champions League, it's another fairy tale on the back of last season's incredible title success. But in the league, their title defence has really started to fall away dramatically in the last few weeks. And there's a lot of concern left for fans that they could become the first reigning champions to be relegated the following season. That hasn't happened since Manchester City. And I think it was in 1938. So I think there's genuine concern that the euphoria and the success that they enjoyed that they feasted on throughout the summer has left them lacking the hunger to go again.
Is that the explanation, Rob? We're talking to you, by the way, in early December. This is, if you're listening to this, it is late December. So Leicester very well may be in the relegation zone now. To what do you attribute the fall off, Rob? I mean, this is a pretty dramatic drop. Not that I think sentient Premiership fans would be completely surprised.
The season before they won the title, they were bottom of the league for 140 days, and it's pretty much the same group of players. So, whilst it's a complete drop away, they had a phenomenal climb last season as well. But I think there's a number of factors. N'Golo Kanté, the French midfielder, was a revelation last season for them. He did the work of two men, and he enabled them to play the system that they adopted so successfully. But he was sold in the summer to Chelsea. They couldn't really stand in his way. He had a release clause in his contract, which Chelsea met. So they lost one of their best players. They managed to keep the rest of them. But I think for me personally, I think those lads were so hungry and driven and determined to achieve something remarkable last season. And now they achieved it, and they spent the summer enjoying the fruits of their labour in many ways. I mean, normally in pre-season we go to Ilkeston and Rotherham and Barnsley for rather unglamorous pre-season warm-up games. This summer we went to LA and we went to Stockholm to take on Barcelona, and then they had the Community Shield at Wembley. It's just been a roller coaster ride that none of these players are used to. They've never been in this situation before, and I think they've found it hard to raise themselves again for the challenge of the Premier League for the following season. The Champions League, they've been able to do it because it's all new, it's all unique for them. But in the Premier League, they've really found it difficult.
Well, what about the opponents? Are they being strategized against in a more intelligent way? Or is it just that everyone wants to beat the champion, and whereas you would not necessarily take the game off, but that wouldn't be the one you circled on your calendar, now it certainly is?
Well, absolutely. I think they took everybody by surprise last season, and I think there was an element that some teams underrated them, but then paid the price for that. And this season, nobody's taking Leicester City lightly. As you quite rightly say, they are a scalp. They are the champions of England, and it is notable that sides like Middlesbrough are raising their game when they take on Leicester City. And I think there's an element as well that Leicester are trying to adopt similar tactics to last season, and the opposition are aware of them now, of their strengths and their weaknesses and where they can hurt them. And they're sort of doing that now. They're doing a number on Leicester City, and they've got to find the answers to that. They've got to respond. They've got to find another way. They've got to find a plan B. And they're just struggling to do that at the moment.
So after, a championship like this, or, after a city comes to prominence kind of out of nowhere, you'll hear people say, oh, that'd really put them on the map. Is that something that actually happened in Leicester? Do you have people like coming to town who never would have come before? Are there kind of tangible changes in the place itself that you've noticed?
Oh, it's done wonders for the economy of Leicester, for the city and of the county. I think the estimate was something like £120 million worth of business came in on the back of Leicester City's title success. But it has put Leicester on the map. I mean, before, people didn't know where Leicester was. I can remember speaking to some American radio shows around the time when they were at the top of the table last season, and they thought that Leicester was just outside London. It was a suburb of London. I have to remind them it was in the Midlands. And one guy couldn't even say Leicester. He called it Leicester. So, people knew absolutely nothing about Leicester and certainly of the football team. But this is what just is evident about sports teams in general. They are a focal point for a community, and when the sports team succeeds and does well, everybody else is aware of what that area is, you know, brings so much money and revenue to Leicester, and it's been remarkable.
Rob, you've had a pretty crazy year yourself. You pounded out a book chronicling the season. You've traveled with this team all over the world. Probably not what you expected when you took on the Leicester beat a few years ago. What were the weirdest things you've seen in the past year?
Oh, I have so many. I mean, the press conferences with Claudio Ranieri have been remarkable. I mean, as they do when the team football team's doing well over here, you know, the local butcher will cook up a sausage specially for them. And we had the Ranieri sausage come to the press conference, which I felt for the butchers because Ranieri wouldn't eat it because it stunk of garlic and it really did stink the whole media suite out. So he was telling them to feed them to his sharks, referred to all the journalists in the room. And then we had a couple of Italian presenters, television show presenters, they invaded one press conference, started dancing around with what looked like chili peppers hanging off their fingers, and it turned out they were bull's horns, which was really bizarre. I mean, the previous manager, Nigel Pearson, was a very downbeat and, you know, a bit dour. But Claudio Ranieri, his press conferences have just been surreal in many ways with some of these strange antics that have been going on. But I think the highlight for me, though, has been going around the world. I mean, surreal just to watch Leicester City take on Barcelona in the International Champions Cup. Coming to LA, that was a magical week in LA, watching them take on Paris Saint-Germain. You know, as I said earlier in the show, when I first started, Leicester City just got promoted back to the Championship, the second tier of English football, having been in League One, the third tier. And, you know, there wasn't much glamour around then. You know, I remember going to Barnsley on a Tuesday night when it's freezing cold and the toilet is just a gutter in the floor at the back of the stand. And now, you know, we're getting used to going to Old Trafford and the Etihad Stadium, the Emirates, Stamford Bridge, and all these great cathedrals to English football. And it's just been such a special time altogether.
You ever watch Behind the Music? Do they have that there? VH1.
Yeah, I've seen Behind the Music, yeah.
It seems like a rise, a fall, and then you could either play it out like Huey Lewis in the news, hey, we had a good time, or it could really destroy you. We'll never be able to capture that again.
Well, I think there's an element to that. I think the Leicester fans sort of realise that, you know, what happened was so unique, yet so special. They don't expect Leicester City to win the title again anytime soon. I mean, I'm sure they would have expected Leicester to have started the season a bit better than they have done, but I don't think anybody was thinking that they were going to go for the title again this season. So they have sort of milked it to the ninth degree, and I don't blame them. They've never won a title before in their history. This is going back to 1884 when Leicester Foss were first formed. That's the original name for Leicester City. And, you know, so they really are enjoying themselves, but it does feel like, you know, that was just a once-in-a-lifetime moment, and so is the Champions League this year. So they won't qualify for next season unless they win it, and I can't see that. So I think everybody's just determined to enjoy the ride.
Jamie Vardy, as we speak, hasn't scored in 16 games. Yeah. Is that biopic still on the table? Have they started filming that yet? Because they better finish pretty quickly, I think.
Yeah, I think they are very much in production for that.
They are. Okay.
That will happen, yeah. That film will happen, and they were in the middle of casting the last I heard, and getting all the arrangements in place, because what happened last season was such a fairy tale. It was a Hollywood movie, wasn't it, in many ways? You know, a lad from the back streets of Sheffield, rejected by his hometown club, gave up football for a while, had to play with an ankle tag on because he got into trouble with the police, and then suddenly become the hot shot of the English Premier League. And he's found it a lot more difficult this season, though. It's not a case of him missing chances. They're not creating chances for him now. And he just looks like he's a confidence player anyway. I can remember when he first joined the club and he admitted then that he thought the jump up from non-league straight to the Championship, the second tier, he felt was too much for him, and he didn't believe in himself, and a lot of the coaching staff got around him and tried to help him in that regard. And when he's full of confidence, you see he flies, but at the moment he's really struggling. He might need to be taken out of the side for a couple of weeks and just for him just to reflect and then come back a little bit fresher. But it's a real bit of a struggle for him at the moment.
So my final thought is, you know, we've talked a lot about the team, and maybe it's harder for them to get motivated this year after, you know, having won it last season. Are you kind of becoming a handful in the Leicester Mercury office? Are people like, man, Tanner is just like so being such a jerk now, you know, because he won the championship, and you know that guy's you know his writing's just not up to stuff anymore. Like, are you becoming a handful for your colleagues?
Oh, absolutely not. They hardly ever see me. I'm never in the office these days. I'm here, there, and everywhere following Leicester City around. I mean, as we record this tomorrow morning, I'm flying out to Portugal for Porto. That'll take me out of the office for 3 days. And next week, we've got an away game down in Bournemouth on the south coast. So I'll be stopping over in Bournemouth. So they hardly ever see me in the office. I think when I wander in sometimes, I think I'm a complete stranger who's just walking off the street. I'm surprised security don't stop me every now and then. In fact, my security pass didn't work the last time I went to the office because I've been away that long. So, they don't really know what to make of it all.
All right, Rob Tanner is the author of 5001, The Leicester City Story, and he covers Leicester City for the Leicester Mercury. Rob, thank you so much for coming back on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Thank you very much.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
For our next guest on our year-end show, the listeners demanded the favorite hang-up fill-in panelist, the Joan Rivers of this podcast. I mean that all in the most positive way that you could invoke the legend Joan Rivers. It's Mina Kimes of ESPN. Hello, Mina.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going fantastic. And we had you on a bunch of times in 2016 to talk about a bunch of different things. But one story of yours that we did not get a chance to talk with you about was your profile of the Bennett brothers, which was my favorite Mina Kimes joint of the year. You enjoyed working on that one, I presume.
Yeah, so I got to do this story in the summer, which is when most of the fun NFL stories happen because the players actually have time to hang out. So I got to spend really like 3 days with Michael and Martellus Bennett just hanging out in LA.
And we've got like a collection of quotes here because ESPN helpfully produced a story that is the best quotes from the Mina Kimes story about Michael and Martellus Bennett.
Oh, they aggregated my own story.
They aggregated your story.
Awesome.
Stefan, you had a favorite one there.
I did. I think Martellus on Eli Manning might be my favorite. He's cool.
Yes.
He's like a normal white guy you see at the park trying to teach his kids how to play soccer, and you know he can't really play soccer himself.
It's perfect. That's one of those moments as a writer when the athlete is so much better at coming up with a comparison that you feel ashamed.
Yeah.
It was so accurate and on the money, I was just kind of went blank for a moment. So good.
So Jay Cutler is not, that one's not really like funny, but it's just candid.
Yes.
Michael says, worst quarterback in the NFL. And his brother, who was on the team with Jay Cutler, says, I'd be open and he'd throw into double coverage.
No, he's not wrong. I think, so basically, yeah, I had a whole section where it's just a list of quotes, mostly critical quotes, I think, because there were so many in the piece that I didn't feel like I could fully just work them into the story. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to have this section. And many of them were pretty negative.
Well, you know what was great about it? Usually when we find a colorful person in the industry that is the NFL, so if it's a quarterback, we allow him to be colorful. But it's usually a person who causes controversy in some way. And then we find out, oh, actually, knee-jerk radio is getting Richard Sherman wrong or whoever it is. But the Bennetts come to us not in the original sin of like committing some huge penalty or being a flashpoint for controversy. You just found them to be delightful, and they were delightful, and we didn't have any of the negativity associated with them.
I think what's also unusual is that they're really good. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the more colorful characters in the NFL tend to be on the margins. The stars in the NFL are usually more muted or political in their quotes, Richard Sherman aside, which is, I think, less to do about alienating other players and more to do about, you know, maintaining their brands and fearful PR people and that kind of thing. But the Bennetts are both elite players at their positions, which is why I was kind of so amazed. It's so rare to find a star who's willing to be candid.
Right. They come off as inoffensive even when they're being offensive. They're hard not to like. They're impossible not to like.
I don't
like.
Know if Jason Witten agrees with that. Well, I found them inoffensive. You say that. I say that. But, you know, it was there. When the quotes came out, they were a little bit divisive.
What was the Jason Witten one?
I hated Jason Witten.
I appreciated his game, but I always hated him. But what they've done is, I think, told fans that, look, this is a workplace like any other. There are a lot of assholes on NFL teams, and not everybody gets along with everybody else. Jay Cutler alienated players in his locker room from the day he showed up in Denver. I was in the locker room that summer when Jay Cutler showed up and alienated everybody and was a shithead.
You were open that whole summer and he just threw into double coverage.
It's accurate, right? I mean, they're saying things like maybe they called J.J. Watt corny. This isn't the first NFL player who I've talked to who feels that way about J.J. Watt. It's just that they're going on the record with these things.
So there's another category of player who we didn't mention who's colorful, and that's like – Terrell Suggs, who's like, oh, I went to Ball So Hard University, T Sizzle, and like writers celebrate him. And he's just an enormous asshole who's like who's a domestic abuser.
Right. The guy who takes the opportunity when they do the on screen identification will say something wacky about his elementary school.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is a conscious decision on Suggs's part, but it seems like the way that it's played out is that his like so-called wacky personality obscures what his real personality is. And you get the sense that, you know, a lot of times people are like, oh, this guy's unfiltered. But it does seem legitimately like you were getting who these guys really are, and that fans and people who read your story are getting a sense of who they really are.
I think it speaks to what people crave out of NFL players because it's all too rare, which is authenticity. Right. I mean, the reason we love Steve Smith Sr., who also says crazy stuff, which tends to be more tinted with just his insane competitiveness and aggression, is that we believe him when he says, you know, he wants to play so hard that people have to put on goggles because there's going to be blood and guts on the field. You believe him when he says that, which is crazy, you know, and I think that
I love that he's concerned enough about the fact that there's going to be blood and guts that he wants the other players to wear protective eyewear. Yeah.
He's thoughtful. He's also old, which, you know, he's 37, which in NFL years is like 80. So he has that kind of like the older he gets, the more he can get away with, I think. And it hasn't abated at all. He continues to talk just so much shit every year after year. But he's believable. And I think these guys are believable, too, when they say stuff.
Right. And it's beyond believability, though, because it's also that they are interesting people who have a moral and social consciences, who have thoughts that have and have ambitions that extend beyond their careers. They are the NFL players who are willing to say the truth about the NFL is that it's temporary, it's violent, it's damaging, and I've got other interests.
And that's, I think, refreshing to hear as a fan. I mean, it actually makes you like the NFL more, knowing that you're not just watching these guys who are playing the best 3 years of their lives and that's it, knowing that it's actually something they've chosen to do, but they have this life outside of football.
Although I bet that you analyze this and you say, well, why was that article so good? Because I had such good subjects. Why were they good subjects? Well, the dynamic was they were playing to each other. It wasn't reporter and subject. They could make each other laugh and you were there to write it all down. I don't know if there's a way to...
Wait, Mike, you're forgetting this part of the story. I ask him what he grows there. Martellus leans over and interrupts. D's nuts.
They didn't know about BOFA. I think I left this out of the story.
Oh, my God.
So I BOFA'd Tellus, and he was like, what did you just do to me? And he was so delighted that he then proceeded to BOFA like three people in front of me over the course of the weekend. Who knows how many people have experienced the greatness of BOFA just because of me.
I hope that we have a family listening to this podcast over Christmas around the tree, and the husband leans over to the wife and says, what's BOFA, honey?
Oh, it's a gift that keeps on giving. Yeah, but you're right. Part of the nice thing about this was getting to watch them play off each other, which I think also engendered a greater amount of honesty than you would have with just a reporter and a stranger in a room.
They're also brothers. Yeah. They also have an interesting background. They have stories to tell from their childhood that are emotional and really tear-jerking. Which one got sick?
Which Michael ones? Did, yeah. And so
what happened? His appendix burst when he was 9 years old?
Yeah, he was hospitalized for several months. That's their theory as to why he's 6'4 and Martellus is 6'7. But I don't know if that's true. But yeah, he was really, really sick. His appendix burst, and they caught it just at the last second. And when they were telling me this story, as I mentioned in my piece, they both started crying. And it was so jarring and unexpected given the tone of the rest of the interview that I was almost like, are they screwing with me? But they actually were very emotional. I mean,
it's an elaborate setup to like a months long D's nuts joke that hasn't yet concluded. Yeah.
I want to ask you something. You mentioned that, I mean, or we all mentioned that it seems so insane to us that the NFL markets these players as just part of a machine, and we very much want to find out about their personality, and it's refreshing to us as fans. And when we look at the NBA, they seem more like real people. But I wonder if the NFL is really miscalculating, because there is a good percentage of its fan base that is, cranky old white guy who bemoans the fact that no one raps when they tackle, and that's why they like the NFL for, you know, the old school portions. And so then a niche within covering the NFL or NFL culture can be these kinds of stories. And with the way the media works now, is if you want to find that, I suppose you can, and everyone is therefore satisfied. Or am I being too kind to the stodgy old white guys running the NFL?
I think you're right about the specifics of these guys. And, you know, they do say provocative things. And, you know, there's a certain subsect in a population that doesn't like it when Michael Bennett talks about Black Lives Matter in an interview. And then there's a large population that loves it, you know, including myself. But I think NFL fans, regardless of how old or white or male they are, do crave some sort of glimpse into the humanity of these players. I made a joke the other day when it was during a Cowboys game when Dak fumbled that they should cut to Tony Romo. And if it was like The Bachelor, they would have him for like an in-camera interview just ready every time Dak screws up. But people would love, it's a joke, but like people love that. Every time they cut to Romo, it's like so enthralling and enticing to be reminded that these are human beings who are feeling real things and competing for their jobs. And I do think the NFL would benefit from exposing that as much as possible.
Cutting to Jay Cutler too, by the way. Jay Cutler does serve that purpose as well when he's on the sidelines or on the exercise
bike. When he wears the floor-length windbreaker coat with the hood up, that's my favorite Jay Cutler on the sideline shot.
His faces are amazing. Yeah. Everybody loves it. You're like, oh my God, who is this guy? You know, and people want that. I don't care how old or whatever, you want it. It's this soap opera for, you know, old men.
A couple other questions for me. Martellus has this animation company called Stupid Buddy Studios. Is he just wasting his money?
That's not his company. So he has a company that's just a small creative agency called the Imagination Agency.
Okay.
So he's just working with them.
He's
part. Yeah. So that's actually a very successful business. I think they have produced a few animated shows.
But is Martellus's company going to be a success, or is he just throwing his money away?
I have no idea. I also had to recently move to LA, and I have no idea what success is here because everyone's always doing stuff like this here.
Yeah.
Like when Martellus was like, I'm working on a show. And I'm like, yeah, you and everyone else here in LA. So
yeah. And then the more successful you get, the more you dress like a homeless guy. So you can't even tell from external signifiers.
It's just perplexing. I have no idea.
And so I imagine I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Brian Curtis just did this piece for The Ringer on the Warriors and how they're covered, and went into some of the differences in the players and their interactions with the media. And like Draymond will apparently explicitly say to the reporters before he says a provocative quote, like, hey guys, I'm going to give you something good right here. And he's like, he knows exactly what he's doing, and he's like excited to like have people report like the crazy stuff that he says. And so I'd imagine that like when your story came out and their quotes about Eli Manning and Jay Cutler were in there, like they weren't pissed off at you. Like they knew what they were saying, and like their intentions were on the page.
I think that they knew, but some of the stuff they were a little surprised by, because while they do say very colorful things in press conferences, they're kind of able to prepare for that. In this case, I was such a fly on the wall that they forgot a lot of the stuff that they were saying to each other. Some of them, they were like, oh man, like I forgot that I said that, and wow, people are really running with it. And that was a little bit surprising. But unlike many players in the NFL, they're pretty open about who they are and sort of prepared to deal with the consequences of that being revealed.
You know, aside from the cutting quotes about Eli Manning and Jason Witten and Jay Cutler. I thought the most provocative thing in the piece, Mina, was when Martellus said to you, do you know what the NFL stands for? And you either said or you write, no fun league, not for long. And he replies, Mina?
Oh, sorry. I didn't want to say it.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Should we say it?
Is that okay? I don't know. It sounds so weird coming out of my mouth.
That's fine. What do you want me to do? N-word for lease?
Yeah, I had never heard that when he said it, which is why I guessed differently. And then afterwards, I Googled it, and it wasn't like a saying, like a widely used thing at all. I don't know if he thought it up or whatever, but I was pretty shocked. And also, I felt, like you just said, a lot of people didn't really notice that because they were so fixated on the Jason Witten and Jay Cutler disses, rightfully so, perhaps. But it is a very provocative and perhaps, you know, accurate statement, I thought.
Yeah, and I think it demonstrates the depth of their thought about their profession, and that even though they are successful NFL players who are among the minority that have made literally millions of dollars, they recognize that in the scope of the revenue of this league and the ownership structure and the fact that there have been, as they point out to you, zero African-American owners in this league, that their goals in life aren't just to play. They are, as Martellus says, I want to build, I want to make. Growing up, black people never owned anything.
Yeah, you asked earlier, or Josh asked earlier, about his creative agency and kind of what his game there was. And I think that really plays into it, which is that they're both very interested and almost obsessed with this concept of ownership, you know, being providing a service that they could be cut at any time. They know all too well that they're not owners and they don't have control, wanting to be able to at least convert that or leverage it into some source of long-term wealth is very important to them. And I think a really interesting, I guess, view on the NFL.
Cool. All right, Mina, thank you so much for being a loyal hang-up panelist, the fan favorite.
I still get emails about that weird Patrick Peterson story. It's the worst. But yeah, thank you for having me.
All right. And just make sure you eat first before you go to Patrick Peterson's mom's house next time.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I will.
For our last interview of the year, we're going to go back to one of our favorites and one of the crowd favorites. It's Ann Beatty. We spoke to her after her husband, Zelmo, was elected to the Basketball Hall of Fame in September. Ann, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
What's new in life since we last spoke?
Nothing, unfortunately.
There was a lot of ground that we didn't get to cover in our first interview, though. So after we talked, we found this article from 1965 from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch when Zelmo was on the Hawks that got into sort of the tips that you would give him about his game, about, you know, where you would get the box score and look at it with him on the car after the games. Do you remember that?
Yeah, because I went to all the games unless I was ill or the children were ill. So, you know, I watched. I was interested. I still watch. So,
I love the headline on the story, which is Ann Beattie's savvy keeps Big Z minding P's and Q's.
Oh, that's how they put it. It's been so long ago, you know, I don't remember.
The impression that the story gives, though, is that you were a, you know, you were a close watcher of what was happening on the court and wanted to examine the box score to help Zelmo mind his P's and Q's.
Yeah. I tried to help.
Which were the statistics that you would hone in on? Were there thresholds to get, or were they against opponents? Give me a typical Ann Beattie talking to her husband. Oh, you got out-rebounded today, Big Z.
I'm trying to remember. I can't remember any particular stat like today. You know, there's so many. Probably scoring. I watched that. Because usually they're paid for scoring, not for the other things, you know.
Right.
And Zelmo was a great defender, you know. That doesn't show up in the box score, as they say.
Yeah. I think on one of his teams, they penalized him if they didn't defend or rebound properly.
Like they would take their money away?
Yeah. You know, $5 here. We're talking way back. And so today it would not work unless they had to pay a lot more. But then it gave them incentive because they were paid if they did well, too. So, you know, a little extra.
What kind of a critic were you? How did you massage the psychology of the professional athlete? And how was Zelmo in terms of taking your criticism and your coaching tips?
Yeah, would he be like in a bad mood if they lost?
Sometimes there was depression when they'd lose. Especially in the playoffs, if they lost too soon. The way we discussed it, there was never any problem with it. I wasn't, you know, terrible or anything. I was just trying to be a good critic.
Well, if so nothing else, it seems to have added structure and accountability. And I think that if you study athletes, there are different ways that they get their motivation, some intrinsic, some extrinsic. Perhaps it even strengthened your relationship. There's basically everything good about this tradition from a performance standpoint, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, some of the guys need their families to be involved. And some of them don't, but he preferred the family angle. So I would just pay attention, and we'd discuss it, and probably also how the team played around him on that particular night. So since there were five of them, you know.
So you guys met at Prairie View in college. What was it like at school, and how did you guys meet?
I was working in the dining hall. They called it mess halls during those times, like the army. Anyway, and so he had a friend that worked next to me, someone he knew from high school, and he was quiet in a way, but he was always trying to charm extra food, you know, so he had a way of doing it. And I met him through his friend from high school.
So was he trying to, like, go after all the people that worked in the dining hall? Like,
No, he was getting extra pork chops, you know, that kind of thing.
but my question is, like, did it make you feel less special because he was asking everyone for extra pork chops and not just you?
No, because probably I was on the meat that particular day. No, it didn't bother me.
I read a story that said that there was a game that we used to go, as you said, to all the college basketball games. And Zelmo was quoted as saying that you always sat in the exact same spot. And there was a game, he is quoted as saying that we were playing Jackson State for the right to go to the National Small College Tournament. We had a very poor first half. When we came out for the second half, I saw that Anne wasn't sitting where she should be. In fact, I couldn't locate her at all. I wondered if she had gotten so disgusted with us that she had left.
I probably didn't leave. I probably just couldn't get that particular seat.
You said that you moved up a lot farther in the stands and that I thought he'd get the idea all right. So maybe you were disgusted with Zelmo's play and the team's play.
There were some days, not many, because he was a fighter, but there were some days where You know, they just don't have it. It's just not there on some days.
Yeah. Yeah. When you were dating him in college, or even when you met him in that pork chop gambit that you described, was he literally the big man on campus? He was the big Z, but was the status of the athlete as exalted back then as it is now? You know, gods on a campus sort of thing?
To a degree. Now, remember that you have the football team first,
mm-hmm,
during those days, and then the basketball players. But, you know, because of his size and his personality, he was easier to like or get along with, because the football players were usually obnoxious and, you know, not endearing to most girls. So that probably was the difference. He and his teammates were good guys.
What about the refs? Like, Would he complain about the refs? Would you complain about the refs? Were you ever in the stands and just like yelling, like, you know, I can't believe you made that call?
No. I mean, I would complain about the refs to him or, you know, some of our friends or teammates, but never, no, I never said anything to the refs. The only time I spoke out to someone was a fan in St. Louis who... I think Sam might have been a rookie that year. And he was, you know how some people get one person they're just going to beat up on that night?
Yeah.
And
uh-huh.
He just went on and on and on. And I was probably six seats from him. And I finally said something to him.
Wow.
And he stopped because I let him know, okay, that's enough. But other than that, I never said anything to anyone in the stands.
Were the crowds back then, like in St. Louis, was it kind of a mixed crowd, like white fans, black fans, or, you know, what was the scene like at the Hawks games?
Probably, there were a few blacks, but probably mostly whites, you know, not a lot of blacks, but a few loyal blacks you always had there.
Did you notice much of a change during Zelmo's career in the makeup of the fan base and the way that black players were treated by fans and by front offices? And I know Zelmo obviously played a role in getting better representation and better acknowledgement and pay for African-American players.
It changed over time, you know, gradually and slowly. And it was tough at times, but, you know, you couldn't really say it was that tough when the, you know, sports salaries were different from everyday people's salaries. So, but in the big picture, it was, at times it was rough.
Now, one thing we haven't talked about, was he a player coach in the ABA with the Virginia Squires?
Yes, he went there. I never went, but he went there and he tried, and that was interesting.
So what did he, what were his reflections on trying to coach a team, not just play on them?
Well, at times they didn't have enough funds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the money wasn't there. And so the players, they didn't know sometimes when they'd go to the games if they would even have a game because of the salaries. But that's the most I knew about that. That was one of the teams where they owed him money in the end. He never received it.
Hmm. Yeah,
I think the
Virginia Squires went out of business the year he coached. I guess they were taken over by the league or possibly no one. And that explains why they weren't
paid. That you can understand. That's what part of the problem was.
Yeah.
They just didn't even know if they were going to get paid sometimes.
Yeah, well, the NBA now is a little different. I guess that was the ABA. But you mentioned that you still keep up with the game. What are your, you know, favorite players now? What teams do you like to watch? And what do you think of the style of play and pro basketball now?
Well, the style today is really exciting. You know, the way they play, because they weren't allowed to do that, you know, during his time. All the wild flying and dunking, it was not allowed. But once the ABA merged with the NBA, a lot of that carried over, and it's exciting, you know, for the younger fans especially. I love watching the Splash Brothers, and now they have Durant, which a lot of people hated, but I think it's interesting that they have him there, too, at his age.
Yeah.
But then there are others, you know. They're the West Coast, so I see them all the time on TV. Who else is there?
Well, I wanted to ask you about Golden State because there's been kind of a split and a lot of, you know, players who came up around Zelma's time or even after said, oh, like, I would never have done like Durant did and gone to a team that had already won a championship. What do you think about that line of thinking?
Well, it's probably easy for them to say that today, but Durant is not. We were in Seattle when he started, and, you know, he's always been good. But I can't remember his age, but, I mean, he's not 25 anymore. So going to a team that would help carry him, a group of younger players, probably was a good move, and it didn't hurt him financially. And
certainly not.
So, I mean, I think the whole thing was to work so you could get paid. So some of the complaints that we've heard were guys, older guys are saying they wouldn't have done it that way. Well, maybe not, but it's not their, you know, it's not their choice.
And what's it been like since the Hall of Fame election and ceremony? And have you had some time to reflect on what that means to you and what it would have meant to Zelma?
For him, it would have meant everything. Like I told you before, we would have had trouble containing him. But for us, it was very nice. We had a good weekend, and we'd never been there before, so it was exciting to see how that works. You know, you see it on TV, but it's nothing like being there. So it's been nice. It was the highlight of our year, so that's a good thing.
What do you get? Do you get swag? Do you have what do you have in your living room to remember the weekend?
We're not quite settled in here yet, but anyway, there's a huge trophy that weighs about 30 pounds. Exaggeration, but it's heavy. They gave them, they inaugurated a new ring. They got that. They got jerseys. They got the jacket, of course. I'm trying to see what else. They do special basketballs, you know, with their images on it. So we have a lot of things we can display with.
Of all the teams you guys were most connected to, I suppose the Hawks would be the most. Now, is Zelmo's uniform retired by the Hawks?
Well, the Hawks, you know, when he left the league and went to the ABA.
Yeah.
And so the Hawks, I don't even know if they claim him very much. The jersey we used in the Hall of Fame was from the Utah Stars.
That was your choice, I imagine.
Yeah, because they had them, you know, naturally he was there last, so we could get more information from them than we could from the Hawks.
Oh, really? So the Hawks don't even act as if this is a part of their history necessarily?
Well, I don't know what happened because, you know, they had trouble finding us to make it to the Hall of Fame celebration, but I don't know what the deal is with the Hawks, because, like I said, when we left, it was not, you know, on friendly terms.
Mm-hmm.
The organization has changed since then, you know, new owners and whatever. And the owner did apologize to him, the one we had when we were there, when he saw him later in life, because it wasn't great. I mean, they didn't even try to pay him to keep him, so... Oh.
But the Stars aren't the Jazz. They were their own team that just sort of went away. So there's no institution. He's in the Hall of Fame as a Utah Star. I don't know if anyone else is. And there's no existing team that he is most tied to, I guess.
I think the Lakers,
right.
You know, because that was his last year to get his retirement. So the Lakers, you know, there's a jersey there, and you have the Stars. The Hawks, it's they recognize him, but it's minor. It's not like, you know, they really remembered him or anything. Like I said, because when he left, it wasn't good.
Right.
He had to sit out that year. So that was hard to deal with because they didn't want him, but they didn't want him to go to the ABA naturally.
Right. It is funny. We know the big stories of people, famous old athletes who are maybe disadvantaged by the financial systems. But, you know, Zelmo Beatty, you see his statistics. You don't know what he went through. If there was just, I'm not even saying the CBA where Timothy Mozgov gets $80 million. If there was just an equitable pay structure, we'd have gotten more years, more appreciation, more everything of a guy like Zelmo Beatty and probably hundreds more like him. I don't know. It seems like the parsimonious nature of sports back then diminished the experience and the history a little bit. That's what this teaches me.
Probably. It was like anything else. It was a struggle, you know, over, in a way, the players kind of became unionized so the salaries could go up. But before that, I think I told you, it was really a struggle.
Yeah.
You know, to get the pay, just a little of the pay they should have received.
So I want to ask just one last question for Stefan, because he hasn't asked it, but Stefan wrote a book about Scrabble called Word Freak. And then in this article we were talking about before, I mentioned that you and Zelmo played Scrabble together.
I'll read the quote. It said, Anne might tease me about my free throw shooting or ask me about some particular play, but she knows when to be quiet. If I'm still brooding when we get home, we'll play Scrabble or dominoes or some card game. This warmed my heart, Anne. Just the image of you and Zelmo playing Scrabble in 1965.
You should have seen him play, what's the money game with the kid, Monopoly, with the kids? And they still talk about it. He was terrible. He would not let them win.
What about Scrabble? Did you actually play a bunch?
Well, yeah, but see, Scrabble, now remember, guys don't spell very well.
Guys don't spell.
Well, during that time, I'll take that back. Maybe, no, today they probably can.
This right. guy spells very well.
Yeah, right? The error of men spell. Misspelling.
Yeah.
Giving rise to the phrase manspell. You manspelled that.
Yeah, we talk a lot about how, you know, things have changed in this country, like athletes getting paid more, but people don't talk about how men are better at spelling than they were 50 years ago.
You think they are today with all the technology?
No, it's become more gender equitable though.
Yeah, okay.
And we love talking to you again. Hope you have a great holiday.
Thank you. Thanks for calling and remembering Zelmo. We appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. All right.
It is our honor, Anne. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye. And that is it for us for 2016. We'd love your feedback on what we talked about today. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. We'll also gather links to the stories we discussed at slate.com/hangup. Subscribe in iTunes. You can find us at itunes.com/slatepodcasts. If you liked this year-end show, if you liked what we did this year, please leave us a comment and a rating. It helps us out. Become a fan of Hang Up and Listen on Facebook at facebook.com/hangupandlisten. Our intern is Shane Monahan. Our producer is Mickey Kapper. The executive producer of Slate's podcast is Steve Lichtai. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. Hang Up and Listen is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Remember Zelmo Beatty. And thanks for listening.